From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
He's got a beard that's long and white.
He's got a beard that's long and white.
Who comes around on a special night?
Santa comes around on a special night.
Special night, beard that's white. Must be Santa. Must be Santa. Must be Santa. Santa Claus.
On today's Fresh Air, our film critic John Powers joins us to talk about new movies opening for the holidays and the movies that made his year's 10 best list. Also, critic Maureen Corrigan picks her favorite books of the year, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD from singer-songwriter Juliana Ray. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
Who's got a big red cherry nose?
That's got a big red cherry nose.
Who laughs this way? Ho, ho, ho.
First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Mac Lee. U.S. warplanes today carried out their first major strike in several days, hitting a convoy of vehicles in eastern Afghanistan. U.S. officials say Taliban or al-Qaeda leaders were in the group, although that claim is disputed. From the Pentagon, NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
U.S. planes have mostly stopped bombing in Afghanistan. There haven't been obvious targets to hit, U.S. officials say. And then suddenly came news of a suspicious movement on the ground. Marine General Peter Pace is vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
We had some intelligence indicators that were cross-referenced and were determined by Central Command that, in fact, what we had was a convoy of vehicles, about 10 to 12. That contained leadership.
AC-130 gunships and fighter aircraft bombed the convoy, destroying the vehicles and killing many people, U.S. officials say. General Pace and others here say they're convinced the people in the vehicles were Taliban or al-Qaeda leaders. Reports from the region quote local officials as saying the convoy was of Afghan tribal leaders who were headed to Kabul for the installation of the new government. But officials here are sticking by their claim. Tom Gelton, NPR News, the Pentagon.
The first group of international peacekeepers has arrived in the Afghan capital of Kabul. The British soldiers are the first members of a UN-mandated force that could grow to about 5,000. The troops took up their positions one day before Afghanistan's new interim government takes office. Russian President Vladimir Putin and British Prime Minister Tony Blair agreed to establish a working committee to share greater intelligence in the war on terrorism. The two men will spend their two-day meeting at the Prime Minister's country retreat in private one-on-one discussions on the next phase of efforts to curb international terror. From London, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
Possible U.S. action against Iraq, which is said to have renovated its nuclear weapons program, alarms Russia as well as poses tricky questions for Britain. While Tony Blair sidestepped the issue of any U.S. strikes, Vladimir Putin signaled his displeasure, saying weapons of mass destruction are a global issue best dealt with in the U.N. The British leader paid homage to the unusually warm relationship he's developed with the Russian leader, calling their partnership unprecedentedly close. President Putin, heard through an interpreter, spoke of improved Russia-NATO relations and a new joint council set to begin in May 2002.
And most importantly, this is one of the few realistic possibilities and options to change the situation in the world with the view of creating a single security system in Europe.
Julie McCarthy, NPR News, London.
Amnesty International is urging British Prime Minister Tony Blair to speak out against alleged human rights abuses in Chechnya while meeting with the Russian president. It says Russia's military has committed numerous atrocities in Chechnya, and criticism has been muted in exchange for Russia's approval of the campaign in Afghanistan and the war on terrorism. It was a winning session on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 50 points to 10,035. The Nasdaq climbed 27 points to 1,945. And the S&P 500 gained 5. This is NPR News. The World Health Organization believes an outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus in the West African country of Gabon may have peaked. The WHO is confirming a total of 27 Ebola cases, 15 of them were fatal. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The World Health Organization says the Ebola outbreak is not getting worse. WHO spokesman Ian Simpson says the number of reported infections is increasing because international experts are doing a good job of tracking down people who've contracted the virus.
I mean, we believe that this outbreak is at its peak. We believe that we have identified all the contacts of the people who've been infected, and they are now being monitored, and any sign of sickness is being investigated.
WHO confirms that Ebola has spread from Gabon into the neighboring Republic of Congo, but denies this is a new outbreak of the disease. It notes the cases in the Congo are part of the same group of infected people first seen in Gabon, and WHO is treating this as a single outbreak. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
The most violent year in New York City history was also one of the safest in terms of street crime. The year that saw nearly 3,000 people killed in a terrorist attack was one in which homicides were at their lowest level since the 1960s. The FBI says those who died in the September 11th attacks will be counted as homicide victims in its annual crime report. However, New York City will not record the deaths in its homicide total. It considers them to be the result of an act of war. Highway tunnel in the Swiss Alps that was the scene of a deadly crash that killed 11 people 2 months ago has reopened. The accident occurred when two trucks crashed head-on and then burst into flames. The accident brought calls for a total ban on truck traffic in the 10-mile-long tunnel. I'm Mac Lee, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the NPR online shop, offering a variety of unique NPR-related merchandise on the web at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For movie fans, this is the time of year for new holiday releases and end-of-the-year 10 best lists. Our film critic John Powers will give us his picks for the best of the year a little later, but first we're going to talk about the new movies that are opening for the holidays. John, let's start with Ali, which is opening Christmas Day. It's been very heavily advertised. Will Smith stars as Muhammad Ali. How is it?
It's actually pretty good. I had some doubts about the film in advance, because even though Michael Mann made it, and he's an interesting, talented filmmaker, there's something about biographical films that tends to make things extremely boring. But what Mann has done is he's taken a 10-year period of Ali's life, basically from 1964 to 1974, the time from shortly before his fight with Sonny Liston, in which Cassius Clay won the title and became Muhammad Ali, to the period where he beat George Foreman in Zaire, and uses that as a way not only of showing you Ali's life, which is rather familiar, but of expanding out to offer a portrait of black culture during that same period. A portrait that includes everything from Sam Cooke, who was a friend of Ali, through the black Muslim movement, through the anti-war part of black life that Ali came to represent, and then finally to the sort of pan-Africanist ideals of Ali in the fight in Zaire.
How does Will Smith do as Muhammad Ali?
He's actually rather blank. I think they must have made some choice that they weren't going to try to take you inside Ali. He's too iconic in a way, and I think they didn't want to try to dramatize him. So more or less, it's an external performance, and deliberately so. It's rather convincing much of the time. You know, the odd thing about it is that Smith, who's so great at being light and exuberant, doesn't quite capture the lightness and exuberance of Ali. He captures many of the other things, so he actually moves around the ring very well. He's bulked up effectively. He's very good at being sober and complicated, but what he's not so good at is being delightful.
I think a lot of TV and theatrical movies that are set in the recent past have this fake picture postcard look about them, and a lot of the cast looks like they've assembled for a theme party where you're supposed to come dressed like it's the 60s or the 70s. Does Ali have that kind of fake look to it in terms of, you know, the costumes and people's hairdos?
No, it actually doesn't. I think that it's probably, like most Hollywood films, a bit too precise in its art direction and costuming, which is to say that everyone is dressed a little bit too much perfectly in character. But what the director, Michael Mann, has very skillfully done is show you the kinds of places that you never really have seen in movies before, or at least I've never seen in movies before, so that you see the kind of small hotels that an African-American would have stayed in the 1960s, even if he's an extremely famous African-American. It'll actually show you the kinds of houses or apartments where Muhammad Ali would live. And I haven't really seen that before, and at that level, it's extremely interesting. What you don't get are the kinds of things that you used to get on, say, Starsky and Hutch, where with the character of Huggy Bear wearing, you know, purely extravagant costumes and everybody going, wow. There's nothing of that. I mean, the story is the center here, and the background and costuming and all the rest is very, very discreet.
Sounds like you're recommending the film.
I am recommending the film. I mean, it's disappointing in some ways, I should say. It's a cold film, and I think somehow it doesn't build in quite the way I would like it to. So at the end, I didn't think I'd gotten all that much by the end. Yet, strange as I was watching it, I was engrossed at every moment watching the film.
Now, In the Bedroom is opening in more cities on Christmas. And this has already won the L.A. Film Critics Award for Best Film. You're part of that group, John. And
yes.
The New York Film Critics voted the two leads, Tom Wilkinson and Sissy Spacek, Best Actor and Actress of the Year. What did you think of the movie?
I think it's a good film that perhaps has been a little bit overrated. And I don't mean that as a negative thing. I think it is one of the better films of the year. And it's an extraordinarily good first film by the director, Todd Field. I guess my thought about the film is that it's the kind of small, humane film that people are going to especially like in the aftermath of September 11th. It's a story about a couple who seem to be happily married, who suffer a great personal loss in their life, a death, and more or less what that does to their relationship and to their sense of justice in the universe. It has two excellent performances, one by Sissy Spacek, and in particular one by the actor Tom Wilkinson, who many of you might remember as the unemployed foreman from The Full Monty, who gives probably the performance of his life as a father who loses a child and as a husband who feels that he's losing his wife, who's very angry with him when the child is lost.
Without giving away the ending, John, I was wondering if, for all the realism and subtlety of the movie, if the ending seemed kind of false to you.
It did seem false to me. I think that's one reason why I don't think it's quite so good as people are saying, is that one of the problems with films as opposed to short stories, and this is based on a short story by André Debussy, is that films tend to need a little bit more of a wallop at the end, whereas one of the great things about short stories is they can be more muted. And I think that what happens in the film of In the Bedroom is that you need to build up to something slightly larger and more dramatic. It did ring false to me. It's not so much the events of it, but even in some of the ways that it's photographed and paced, it made it seem like a little bit more of a thriller by the end than the character study that had been earlier.
Let's look at Lord of the Rings. Did you go into this as a Hobbit fan?
Well, I had read the books when I was quite young. And so I guess at that level I was a Hobbit fan, although it must have been, you know, several decades since I've actually wanted to read about an elf. So at that level, I probably didn't go in. And I'm one of those people, like many people in the audience, who, when I see names like Frodo, my heart kind of sinks. I like, you know, films where people are named Jim. And so I would say that when I went into the theater, I wasn't completely convinced that I wanted to be there. And for the first 20 minutes, I really thought, I'm in trouble. The film is 3 hours long. It was 20 minutes in, and I was looking at my watch and thinking, I'm now caught in Middle Earth with these little people with hairy feet for hours and hours and hours. But a strange thing happened about 20 or 30 minutes in, which is the story suddenly kicks into gear, and the film becomes extremely absorbing. Probably two of the 3 hours are extremely good. You know, they're moving and fast-paced with absolutely spectacular production design. You know, one of the funny things about the film is it's one of the most expensive projects in the history of filmmaking. It's actually a trilogy of films made all at the same time, and the combined cost was $270 million. And when you hear a number like that, it seems incredible that anyone could spend that much on a film. Yet when you watch Lord of the Rings, you can actually see where the money went. I mean, it is visually sumptuous, incredibly elaborate, extraordinarily precise in all its details of creating an alternative universe. So between the production design, the extremely good acting, fine directing, it's actually a good film.
How would you compare it to the Harry Potter movie?
I think the Harry Potter movie had some of the same limitations, which is to say that the fans of both Potter and Tolkien are incredibly literal-minded. They don't want you to change anything. So you're stuck with the fact that any change you make gets you in trouble. Both were caught that way. The difference between the two is that the Harry Potter film is essentially a corporate product. And the film of Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Rings, which is its actual title, it's the Lord of the Rings, the Fellowship of the Ring, is quite different. It was made by a New Zealand director named Peter Jackson, who shot it in his home country, and it's an extremely personal film. You actually, when you're watching it, you can tell that one guy made it, one guy's imagination is at work in it, and it has a kind of homegrown, organic quality, whereas Harry Potter feels as though it was put together partly with marketing ideas in mind, partly out of fear that the kids who read the books won't like the version you're doing. And so there's a very different feeling to the two films.
Let's move to The Shipping News, which is based on the Annie Prue novel of the same name. That's going to be opening in a lot of cities for the holidays. It'll be opening in more cities in the weeks to come. Did you read the novel before seeing the movie?
Well, I'd read the novel when it came out, and I didn't go back to reread it. But yes, I had read it. And, you know, what was striking about the novel was the language in particular. It wasn't so much the story of the novel, which is about a sort of schlubby guy named Coyle's redemption as he goes from being one of life's losers to regaining confidence, going back to his ancestral home in Newfoundland and finding a new life. That part of the story hadn't struck me so much as the way that E. Annie Proulx had told the story. In the film adaptation, what's lost is that narrative voice. And so what you have is a slightly wan adaptation of a story that looks much less good when you see it on screen than it felt when you read it in the book.
Kevin Spacey's the lead. How is he?
Kevin Spacey is making a serious career mistake. I don't usually give career advice. You know, it's not my job. But for some reason, ever since American Beauty, he's decided that he wants to be lovable. And the problem is that no one wants to love Kevin Spacey for being lovable. You know, we want to love him for being a jerk. I mean, if you look at the great Kevin Spacey roles, he's always ironic and nasty. And then maybe at the end, as in L.A. Confidential, you'll discover that there's a bit of humanity beneath the smugness and the irony and the jerkiness. But ever since American Beauty, he's begun casting himself in roles where he's playing, you know, wounded masculinity, the sensitive male. And this is perhaps the most extreme example of that, where he's even playing a sensitive kind of dumb guy. And I think that no one in America thinks of Kevin Spacey as a sensitive, wounded kind of dumb guy.
So is this one you think we should avoid, or is it just worth going to but not great?
It's. I guess you could go. I mean,
okay.
I try to be fair in these things, Terry. You know, which is, I mean, why I talk to people who've seen it, and I think the general sense is the same sense I have, which is it's a rather disappointing film, and one of the major problems with the film is Spacey.
Film critic John Powers is my guest. We're talking about movies opening for the holidays. John, I'm going to ask you to just put in a word for a film that you recently reviewed, The Royal Tenenbaums, but this will be opening in a lot of cities for the Christmas holidays. So tell us why you liked it so much.
Yes. Well, I think it's actually one of the films this year that is both funny and touching at the same time, often in the same scene at the same moment. It's a story about a bunch of kids who were once geniuses who aren't any longer, and they now have to come to terms with their father, played by Gene Hackman. And what's good about this film is it captures the weird dynamics of family life in a way that you don't normally see in films. And at the same time, it's got very offbeat sense of humor and this peculiar ability to make you laugh at something while you're feeling really sad at the same time. The reason I want to mention it is that this is a film that's been largely neglected by critics groups and won't have the big advertising budget of films like Ali or Lord of the Rings. Yet it's a really, really good film, one of the best films of the year, and I don't want to see it neglected.
Why do you think that The Royal Tenenbaums didn't make it on more 10 best lists, or at least not yet?
I think The Royal Tenenbaums is a tricky film, and that many people are judging it in relation to other things than the film itself. So some will say, oh, it's like a Salinger story, and then it's not like a Salinger story, and then they think it's a failed Salinger story. Or they'll say, oh, it's like The Magnificent Ambersons by Orson Welles, but it's not like The Magnificent Ambersons, so therefore it's not a successful movie. I think the film makes a kind of demand on you that films don't often do, which is it asks you to think and feel different things from moment to moment, and that it kind of sneaks up on you with its emotions. And I think a lot of people, when they see the film, because it's got a lot of jokes and sort of whimsical humor at the beginning, don't grasp that the film's arc keeps getting deeper and deeper and deeper. And so they are sort of stuck on the first part and think, oh, this is a precious comedy. And they never adjust to the fact that part of the structure of the film is to seem exuberant and buoyant and then gradually change into something else.
Anything you think we should avoid over the holidays?
Well, there are a lot of things to avoid over the holidays. I think that I wouldn't go to see The Majestic, the Jim Carrey film, which has been described by one critic as the most boring film ever made. That's probably not true, but it's one of these in a way, that would actually make it sound too interesting. I mean, to see the most boring film ever made is something you might actually want to do. I think that the film that probably will get the best reviews that I don't think is very good is the film A Beautiful Mind, starring Russell Crowe as a mathematician named John Nash, who has a schizophrenic break. From reading the early reviews, most of the critics think that it's an extremely good film. It got a lot of Golden Globe nominations. And the truth is, Russell Crowe is very, very good in the film. He's one of the best actors working anywhere in the world right now. And he's extraordinarily good as a brilliant guy who more or less has problems with personal demons that intrude into his life in ways that none of us normally could possibly imagine. But the film is extremely flat and uninteresting and takes what I think one of the most interesting stories I've ever read and turns it into an obvious inspirational saga. It's sort of the math version of Shine. Now, for a lot of people to say that might seem like an inducement. So if you liked Shine and want to see the math version of that, you probably should race out to see A Beautiful Mind. Since I didn't like Shine, and at least in Shine the guy played the piano rather than just thinking about math, I think that you would probably be wise to avoid it if you didn't like Shine.
Oh, count me in on that one. All right. Well, John, thank you for reviewing some Christmas movies, movies opening for the holidays. And in a few minutes, we'll talk about your 10 best list.
Okay.
John Powers is Fresh Air's film critic, as well as media columnist and executive editor of LA Weekly. He'll be back in the second half of the show. Coming up next, Ken Tucker reviews Juliana Ray's new CD. This is Fresh Air. Singer-songwriter Juliana Ray is probably the only person in pop music who's written songs with both Rufus Wainwright and Kiki Dee. Our rock critic Ken Tucker was a fan of Ray's 1993 debut album called Something Peculiar. Ray has a new collection called Restless Night. Here's Ken's review.
Tonight, there's a new moon on. And the glow it has cast fills this new love.
Although she was born in New York, Juliana Ray has long lived in Los Angeles. And with Restless Night, it sounds to me as if she's created an admirable, insinuating addition to LA pop music. The sort of album you can imagine hearing wafting out of windows in the Hollywood Hills, where, inside, a couple is breaking up.
I wish I could take the world apart. I'd build it again, state of the art. I'd hold the nature.
Juliana Ray, the bruise of heartbreak in her blue voice, has slowed down the tempo since her grievously underrated 1993 pop rock prize, Something Peculiar. On Restless Night, she sings a series of languidly gorgeous ballads that evokes a timeless LA, in which Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe dates 50s siren Julie London and they cool off in Randy Newman's swimming pool. The duet with Rufus Wainwright alone is hot enough to make the pool water boil.
Slow like the grapevine, gently creeping. Would you care for some more wine? Let me pour you some more. Now we're along the locks in.
Ray's chief collaborator on Restless Night is the producer Ethan Johns, who's worked with artists as various as Counting Crows, current critics' favorite Ryan Adams, and the queen of 70s LA pop, Linda Ronstadt. There are moments here when Ray's vocals also conjure up the spirit of another Laurel Canyon woman, Joni Mitchell, before she became contorted with self-consciousness.
Every time I look at you, I see your light refracted through some telescope, projecting you into a black hole night. Dark sky travelers fall in line, wheels engage and hypnotize your troubled mind. Frightened by day's glare, oh, the world's unfair. I won't deny I've wished for a different you too many times. And when I didn't wish, I tried to make it true.
Elsewhere on this collection, Ray has a song called Dark Night of the Soul, which could have been an alternative title for the album, were she not intent on transcending that cliché phrase. On another tune, 1 Hour, Ray and her producer deploy a Latin-tinged rhythm that's like an urban version of a Sergio Leone spaghetti western theme, to sing about how, as she bluntly puts it, love goes rotten. If I was going to drive across the country to L.A., I'd take along tapes of Warren Zevon's first album, Randy Newman's second one called 12 Songs, some CDs by the punk band X, 1977's The Beach Boys' Love You, another underrated L.A. masterwork, and Juliana Ray's Restless Night. I have a hunch this would result in a ride that only director David Lynch could do justice to.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Restless Night by Juliana Ray. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com, and sponsored in part by Nonsuch Records, featuring composer John Adams' El Nino, an oratorio on the Nativity story featuring Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, Dawn Upshaw, and Willard White, conducted by Kent Nagano. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, critic John Powers talks about the films that made his 10 best list for 2001, and critic Maureen Corrigan picks her favorite books of the year.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our film critic John Powers is back with his 10 best list for 2001.
Well, actually, Terry, I don't really have 10 this year. I spent the first half of the year living in Singapore, so I didn't see a lot of films that came out then, especially the foreign films. And so I was on a different time frame than everybody else. But since arriving, I've caught up with a lot of things, and I do manage to have 8 films on my 10 best list. In more or less order of merit, I would put them the re-release of Apocalypse Now, which I think is the best film I saw this year, David Lynch's Mulholland Drive, the small comedy Ghost World, The Royal Tenenbaums, the film by Wes Anderson, a documentary called The Gleaners and I by Agnes Varda, The Lord of the Rings, which manages to be an accomplished fantasy film, which is something I didn't think I would see or like, Gosford Park, the best film that Robert Altman's made in the last 25 years, and Memento, which I think is not a great film, but is such a great puzzle that it's sort of this year's croupier.
Now, you only have 8 films on your 10 best list. I think this was just a particularly frustrating, mediocre year for movies. I know you were gone for part of that year, and that's part of your explanation for only having 8, but would you agree it was not a good year?
I think it's a pretty terrible year, in fact. And I don't think I'm the only one. You know, when I talk to my fellow critics, you know, I find almost all of them saying, oh my gosh, how am I going to find 10 films to really like? And you can do it if you add some of the smaller films that virtually don't get distribution. There was a very interesting Japanese film called Eureka that played in maybe 2 or 3 cities in the United States, and it's on a lot of people's lists. But other than that, it's really hard to find them. I mean, you had a lot of famous filmmakers making films that people don't like very much. I mean, probably the classic example would be AI, which I think was supposed to be the big Oscar film of the year and turned out to be this badly reviewed film that the public didn't like.
Well, Apocalypse Now is at the top of your 10 best list. What do you like about the restored and re-edited version that was released this year that's different from the original version?
Yes. Well, I think just seeing the film again in a pristine print was so exciting that I probably was overly enthusiastic about the changes made in the version. What I guess I liked about it was that the film always felt slightly choppy before. And now the film, running longer than it did before, with scenes set in a French colonial plantation, for instance, gives you a sense of the full conception of the film. You know, one of the funny things about the expanded version is that some of the scenes that are expanded aren't very good, and you can see why Coppola cut them. At the same time, when you watch the film, you see the whole conception, and the conception is so grand that the film suddenly becomes greater in your head. There are lots of small little things that tweak the film in nice ways. You know, for instance, the Martin Sheen character steals Robert Duvall's surfboard in this version of the film. And it helps explain something that was always confusing in the film, which was why his men were so loyal to him. But when you see that he steals the surfboard from the jerk, you suddenly realize, oh, the men will follow him farther than you might otherwise expect. He's a little less tightly wound than he seems in the shorter version. So it's an improvement to the film. And there are lots of small things like this that make the film better.
Ghost World is on your 10 best list. This was a fine film, not a big money motion picture. Good performances, really nice colors even. I mean, it's set in a world of people who really like comic books and pop music. And the whole coloring of the movie seemed to reflect that. Tell us why you chose the movie.
Well, I think actually you described it very well. It's the story essentially of two teenage girls who are alienated from their larger society. And one is trying to integrate herself a little bit and trying to get on with her life. The other one is more of a fighter. And she gets involved with an aging record collector, wonderfully played by Steve Buscemi in the best performance he's given in several years. And more or less you see this world of people who don't quite fit into the world, and who can't decide whether they should try or whether they should try to create a different world for themselves. And what's nice in the film is that it's extremely funny. There's a marvelous moment where somebody does a painting of Don Knotts that I think has made me laugh louder than anything in the film this year. At the same time, it's extremely sad because the film isn't afraid to show you what it means to spend your life not fitting into the mainstream. It's based on a comic book by an artist named Daniel Close, and the film has a very nice comic book look. It's very, very clean. It's worth noting also that one of the people involved in producing the film was David Lynch. And although it's not really like a David Lynch film, except in its fondness for outsiders, it's, you know, one of the reasons why people like me are so loyal to Lynch is that he would back a film like this one.
And, of course, Lynch's film, Mulholland Drive, is on your 10 best list. I want to get back to Steve Buscemi for a second. He's such a good actor. He was even good in that movie Domestic Disturbance that starred John Travolta, which I thought was, you know, mediocre would be giving it the benefit of the doubt, I think. It was not a good movie, totally formulaic. But Steve Buscemi, those few minutes when he's on screen, the movie actually becomes interesting.
And so I think this is the great Buscemi comeback. I think one of the things that happened with him was that when he first started out in films like Parting Glances, he was really wonderful. And then gradually people thought, oh, he's essentially the live-action version of Bugs Bunny. And they used him to do Buscemi. I think in a credit of one of his films, the character's name is Buscemi, and it's played by Buscemi. And that's because he'd become such a shtick that you just hired him to do that. In the last year or so, people have finally begun realizing that he's a good actor again. And so Ghost World has this wonderful, sad performance with him as a record collector, aging yet attracted to and scared by the teenage heroine of the film. And he's really, really good. I think the New York Film Critics gave him their award for Best Supporting Actor. And, you know, I could only endorse that.
Now, you were living in Singapore when Memento was released, so we never heard your review of Memento. Why did it make it onto your 10 best list?
I guess it's because it's a really wonderful puzzle film that very few films, especially these days, have the courage to fragment a narrative. So in this case, you have the wonderful hook of the guy who's lost all his short-term memory. And what that means in storytelling terms is you have to keep starting and stopping, looping back over and over again. The last movie I think that did that probably was Groundhog Day, which was a comedy.
Right.
Because it's really, really hard, especially in today's film climate, to tell a story that isn't directly linear. People get lost during flashbacks. They don't like the choppiness that you've found in some new wave films from France in the 1960s, for instance. And this is the first film I've seen in years that actually trusted the audience to try to put something together when it wasn't being explained to them at every moment. It also had a really interesting feeling to it because you were disoriented like the hero, who's extremely well played by Guy Pearce. I mean, it's worth mentioning that Guy Pearce, who starred with Russell Crowe in L.A. Confidential and who's also Australian, has also become one of the more convincing American actors around.
Now, The Gleaners and I, which is on your 10 best list, a film by Agnes Varda, is a film that probably most of our listeners won't even have heard of, let alone seen. What is it?
And I think probably it will be on video, and I would urge people to get it. It's a film about, Agnes Varda is a famous new wave film director, and she's now getting on in years. She's making a film about what was called a tradition of gleaning in France, which is basically people who would go to fields, orchards, and so forth, and once everything had been picked, would pick up what was left over. So you would pick the apples that haven't been picked. You pick the potatoes that the machines can no longer get. And you start with the idea of gleaning as an enterprise, and then Varda expands that out to talk about what it means to glean and the changes of gleaning, so that she, in fact, is a gleaner of images. You then have people who are gleaning in city streets. See, she follows homeless people. And so the whole thing becomes a meditation on more or less how people get wasted, how people use things that seem to be wasted, an entire culture in which you're living on the residue of what the regular society wants to throw away. It's funny and smart, very, very sharp, beautifully shot on digital video. It's the kind of film on digital video that makes you realize that anybody could make a film if they had the imagination.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, Moulin Rouge has made it to a few 10 best lists. What did you think of it?
Actually, I thought Moulin Rouge was one of those films that I really wanted to love because I like musicals and I like the big, expansive vision of it. And when I was watching it, if I had taken any 10 minutes, I would have liked those 10 minutes. But the problem was that director Baz Luhrmann has many, many gifts, but one of them is to not realize that every moment doesn't need to be a climax. So you have this huge, expansive, production-designed music and dance-filled extravaganza attached to the thinnest of stories where every scene seems to be played at exactly the same pace. And that finally wore me out, and the story didn't have enough energy to hold me. I like the idea of trying to make a big, exalted film about love. I think Ewan McGregor gives an extremely good performance. I think Nicole Kidman gives a pretty bad performance, very, very cold and distant performance. I thought it was okay. I was stunned to see that it's on people's 10 best lists and that I think won the National Board of Review's best film. It got a bunch of Golden Globe nominations today, but that makes sense because that's the foreign press and they're idiots.
Any performances you want to single out this year? Maybe great performances in mediocre movies that you don't want to go unnoticed?
Well, actually, I think the best single performance I saw by anybody this year was in Mulholland Drive by a woman named Naomi Watts, who probably won't win anything because it's a David Lynch film and people tend not to win things in David Lynch films, and because no one's ever heard of her, so she won't get the critical groundswell. She does a role where she takes, it's more or less a dream role in which she starts as the most innocent young starlet wannabe who ever lived and goes through so many levels of misery and jadedness, sexuality and weirdness, that it's a role that probably asks her to do more than any actress has been asked to do in a film in maybe the last 15 or 20 years, and she's really great doing it. You know, if there were any justice in the world, she would be getting Oscar nominations and lots of work out of this. So I guess she's the one I would single out. You know, there were lots of other performances that I think are really wonderful. Gene Hackman, who I think always seems to give a good performance, is really great in The Royal Tenenbaums. And Billy Bob Thornton, who I thought I was going to spend the rest of my life disliking after Sling Blade, has become, you know, one of the most interesting actors in Hollywood. And he's really good in both this small film called Monster's Ball, which will be coming out, I think, in January, as well as The Man Who Wasn't There, the Coen Brothers film.
One of the movies that I thought was overpraised this year that I've even seen on some 10 best lists is a movie called Deep End, or The Deep End. And this movie seems to kind of represent what I think may be a new genre in American movies, which is the kind of high-class version of a Lifetime movie, Lifetime cable.
Yes. Well, I think what's funny about this movie is that it's essentially a remake of an older film called The Reckless Moment that was filled with energy. And what's happened to this film is that I feel it's been crushed with good taste. The heroine of the film is a sort of Martha Stewart-type woman who's a control freak. And yet you actually feel, when I was watching, I thought, Martha Stewart directed this because everything is so tasteful, you know. Whenever a person's wearing a shirt or a blouse, it always seems to match the wallpaper. The compositions of the shots is so precise that it feels fussy. You sort of know the meaning of everything, so there's no juice to it. You know, I mean, I'm a person who would prefer a messy film with flaws to one that's crushingly perfect. You know, I mean, to compare it to, say, Mulholland Drive by David Lynch, Mulholland Drive has some scenes in it that aren't very good. But there's a lot of passion and vitality and energy, and you don't really quite know what's going to happen. Whereas in a film like Deep End, everything is done so perfectly and so tastefully, there's no room to breathe in it. It's not that it's a bad film. It's just that it's a film that is telling you at every moment, this is a work of art.
My guest is Fresh Air's film critic, John Powers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Fresh Air's film critic, John Powers, and we've been talking about the best movies of the year. John, for a half or two-thirds, I guess a half of this past year, you were living in Singapore. What are movies like in Singapore? Let's start with what was showing. What kind of films were showing?
Well, actually, what's showing in Singapore is essentially what we get. You know, there are a couple cases because they're a day ahead of us because of the timeline where films actually opened in Singapore before they opened here. I think Tomb Raider was one of those films. The big problem in Asia at the moment is that any film that you bring out in the U.S. is pirated and put on cheap VCDs, as they're called, and sold for $2. So that what's happened now is that the Hollywood studios bring out their big films in Singapore and in much of Asia at almost exactly the same time they do it in the United States, because otherwise everyone will have bought them for $2 and played them in their home long before you opened them. I believe that Singapore is famous for having the highest rate of film viewership of any country in the world, which is to say that the average Singaporean sees more films a year than people do in any place else in the world. It's partly because it's a very prosperous country filled with movie theaters, and it's a very hot country, and the movie theaters are air-conditioned.
So when you were watching movies in theaters, were the movies dubbed?
No, actually, Singapore is an English-speaking country. So that they often would have Mandarin subtitles because there's a certain percentage of the population that's still not comfortable in English. But every English language film plays in English, and the official language of Singapore is English. But sometimes you would actually see certain films that would have three or four different levels of subtitling. You might get a print that was going to go to Malaysia and then Thailand. So I've actually seen films where the people would be speaking English, and you would see the layer of Malay subtitling, the layer of Mandarin subtitling, and the layer of Thai subtitling at the bottom of the frame.
My understanding is that the press in Singapore is pretty tightly under the control of the government. There's a limit to what you can say about the government without getting shut down. What's
Yes.
film criticism like in the press in Singapore?
It's frankly terrible. As a person who has written film criticism and reads a lot of it, I was startled at the sheer boosterism of it. I think that Singapore must be the only country in the world where no one thought that Charlie's Angels could be better. It's a place where Godzilla will get a great review. The whole enterprise, and this is partly linked to, I think, once again, to a certain level of repressiveness in the government. The whole enterprise is to keep people entertained. And so there's a level of boosterish promotion in the press about all sorts of entertainment issues that's genuinely shocking. It's really hard to get a bad review for a film in Singapore. They want people to go out to the movies. It's a small country. There's not as much to do as there would be in a larger country. Movie going is big. So they don't want to have a negative reviewing environment.
Are the theaters nice? Are there multiplexes?
There are multiplexes. Some of the big old theaters are going, but there are lots of multiplexes. And they even do the thing that I think they're just beginning to do in the U.S., which is they have special gold pass theaters where for extra money you can go into a theater and sit in something that's not so much a movie theater seat as the equivalent of a first class seat on an airplane where it's a standalone seat, perhaps with a tray, and you can tilt the thing all the way back. And rather than there being, let's say, 500 seats in this theater, there will be 50, and there will be people who come and wait on you. And this seems to be the new thing, both in Singapore, but in the rest of Asia as well, is they're trying to do something to make movie going seem special again. Because what's happening in Singapore is that people now are, as I say, buying illegal discs that do the films for $2, and you can see them in your own home. So you're trying to induce people to go back to the movie theaters.
Did you enjoy the experience of seeing movies that way?
It was actually okay. It felt slightly superfluous to me. I mean, if someone were to offer me a first-class seat on an airplane flight from Singapore to Los Angeles, which is 19 hours, I would happily take it. But to sit down and watch Memento, I'm perfectly content to sit in a traditional movie seat.
Well, John, I'm glad you came back to the States and that you're back on Fresh Air again reviewing movies for us. I want to wish you happy holidays and to thank you for talking with us.
Oh, no, I'm happy to be here, and happy holidays to all our listeners.
John Powers is Fresh Air's film critic, as well as media columnist and executive editor of the LA Weekly. Coming up, critic Maureen Corrigan picks her favorite books of the year. This is Fresh Air. For book critic Maureen Corrigan, it was the year of the horse. Here's her best books list for 2001.
Some books were more consciously profound. Other books were more lyrical. And still other books I never got around to reading. But in my estimation, the winner of Best Book of the Year is Seabiscuit, by a length. Laura Hillenbrand's dazzling account of the horse many aficionados believe was the greatest racehorse of all time gets the garland in part because if anyone had told me that I would one day be raving about the biography of a horse, I'd have snorted a resounding nay. In daredevil prose that sprints along at breakneck speed, Hillenbrand tells the unbelievable tale of Seabiscuit, a one-time loser who tore up the track for 5 years during the late 1930s into 1940. His story, and the story of the down-and-out men who joined together to uncover his championship potential, constitutes an inspiring extreme adventure tale of physical courage and moral grit. A tale that unfolded during a period when the whole country was living out an extreme adventure of its own, called the Great Depression. Other thoroughbred contenders in this year's nonfiction field were Nickel and Dimed, in which social critic Barbara Ehrenreich, like a latter-day Nellie Bly, investigated the realities of not making it in America by working minimum-wage jobs as a hotel maid, cleaning woman, nursing home health aide, and, as she dubs it, a Walmartian. Facing the Wind, by New York Times reporter Julie Salomon, is an intelligent, morally messy story about a Brooklyn lawyer named Bob Rowe, who in 1978 murdered his wife and 3 children, one of whom was severely handicapped. This is one true crime story that forces readers to look long and steadily at the deep sadness of some people's lives. The reprint editions of Joseph Mitchell's sublime collections, My Ears Are Bent and McSorley's Wonderful Saloon, take readers back to a New York of corner candy stores, men in fedoras, and steam heat. Patricia Volk's evocative autobiography, Stuffed, offers a gastronomical tour of lost New York, one that's heavily oriented toward pastrami, Malamars, chopped liver, and cucumber salad. For decades, Volk's family owned Morgan's, a renowned garment center restaurant on West 38th Street. It was the place, Volk writes, where I was princess. Waiters winked at me. They plucked the white linen napkin from under my fork, twirled it high in the air, then draped it over my lap. And when I asked for a hamburger, my grandfather would raise his forearm, then smash through the kitchen indoor and grind a steak himself. Poet Emily Dickinson reportedly made some excellent gingerbread. However, it's not her cooking skills, but her unstandard mind that Alfred Habiger explores in his terrific and testy new biography of Dickinson called My Wars Are Laid Away in Books. Literary fiction gave nonfiction a respectable run for the money this year. Empire Falls by Richard Russo was my favorite novel of the year. In this nearly 500-page, funny and moving, class-conscious story, there's not one false bit of dialogue, not one canned observation. I came a bit late to The Corrections, Jonathan Franzen's much-celebrated novel about an aging Midwestern couple, their 3 adult children, and every minute social observation Franzen could squeeze in about middle-class America in the late 20th century. The sweep and the language of The Corrections are indeed amazing. Here, for instance, is how Franzen describes the dementia of the family patriarch, Alfred Lambert. He had good days and bad days. It was as if when he lay in bed for a night, certain humors pooled in the right or wrong places, like marinade around a flank steak. And in the morning, his nerve endings either had enough of what they needed or did not. As if his mental clarity might depend on something as simple as whether he'd lain on his side or on his back the night before. I also think, however, that Franzen could have used a stern editor more than he needed that star-crossed endorsement from Oprah. some of the cataloging and internal monologues that distinguish the novel go on past the point of at least my interest. Other, less ambitious novels I loved were My Dream of You, Nuala O'Foilan's lyrical meditation on a life lived too cautiously, and Bel Canto by Ann Patchett, about a famous opera singer held hostage by revolutionaries. Patchett's lithe writing style does for this creaky plot what a great singer's voice does for a moth-eaten libretto. Long Time No See by Susan Isaacs, a.k.a. Jane Austen with a schmear, made me happy by bringing back Judith Singer, the first in Isaac's long line of plucky heroines. And Almost by Elizabeth Benedict was the first novel I managed to read after September 11th. Its emotionally profound account of a youngish widow trying to figure out her life's wrong turnings nudged me back into an appreciation of why art matters, even, or especially, in history's most desperate hours.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can find her complete list on our website, freshair.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Roberta Shurrock, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. All of us at Fresh Air wish you happy holidays.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. Next year all our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. Next year all our troubles will be miles away. Once again, as in olden days, happy golden.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Wreck the Halls, A Holiday Mystery by Sarah Graves, and Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we start celebrating the holidays by celebrating great American music with an encore presentation of our series on American popular song. We begin with a tribute to lyricist Dorothy Fields, who co-wrote I'm in the Mood for Love, On the Sunny Side of the Street, The Way You Look Tonight, and many others. Join us for the next Fresh Air.